Okay, well, welcome back to our Ethics 2019 from November 25, 2019. This is the second part of the program. We're picking up with Rule 1.7, which talks about conflicts of interest. And in this portion of the program, I'm just going to go through this very quickly. Well, in fact, I normally just go through it very quickly because Rule 1.7 is one area which definitely does not give you a lot of practical guidance. Because Rule 1.7, the actual text of the rule simply says that you may not represent a client if there's a conflict of interest. Certainly in the situation where it's directly adverse to another client. Obviously, you can't represent both the plaintiff and the defendant. But the general definition of conflict of interest is simply that there's a significant risk that the representation of one or more of your clients will be materially limited. So what does that mean? Well, that, you know, that does not give you very much practical guidance. So that's the reason why I've added the fourth hour to today's program, where we will, you know, dig into that in a little bit more in depth. About what are conflicts of interest. And even in that fourth hour, we're really just going to scratch the surface of what constitutes a conflict of interest. So like I say, it's definitely one area where you don't get a lot of value out of Rule 1.7, just saying that don't engage in conflicts of interest, because you already knew that. We'll go into more detail in the other part of the program. I will point out here, though, that some conflicts of interest can be consented to, but even if the client consents to it, say, yeah, I consent to this conflict of interest, that consent is only valid if you think that you reasonably believe that you can proceed competently. So if it's a minor conflict of interest, that can be consented to, but if it reaches a point, and again, where is that point? Kind of hard to say, but it does reach a point where it can't be consented to. Interestingly, Iowa has a rule, a specific rule, that is a good idea in any state, but it's very explicit in Iowa that you shall never represent both parties in a dissolution of marriage case. It's probably a bad idea, like I say, even if you're in Wisconsin or Minnesota, but you can never do that in Iowa. But in other states, there might be some limited situation where that would be. You know, the spouses are still on speaking terms, and they just mutually recognize that this marriage is just not working out, and we need to file a joint petition for dissolution of marriage. There is such a thing in Minnesota. There's a statute that says you can file a joint petition for dissolution of marriage. Well, if they're represented by an attorney, that attorney would be representing both spouses. Now that's problematic, and it's hardly ever done in Minnesota because, even though they're on speaking terms and they're amicable today, the fact still remains that they decided they can't stand each other anymore. So they might at some point become adverse to one another. So it's frowned upon in Minnesota and Wisconsin, but it's absolutely permitted in Iowa. You can't do that. Where I warn Iowa attorneys to watch out for that is, what about if you're just informally giving advice to this divorcing couple? You don't necessarily practice law full-time, or not in family law anyway, the couple comes to you asking a question, we don't understand these pro se documents, can you explain this to us? Well, I would, in Minnesota, I'd probably feel okay answering that question. In Iowa, I would probably say, well, I can't give advice to both of you in that situation. So watch out for that. Kind of a common conflict of interest situation that you just want to avoid as much as possible, wherever you are, but especially if you're in Iowa. So like I say, Rule 1.7 is just in very, very general terms, kind of hard to pin it down. Rule 1.8 gives a bunch of specific rules, but they're not necessarily very common situations. A lot of them are pretty arcane. But there are situations where a specific rule is called for. So we will spend a little bit more time talking about them. But even though we're talking more about Rule 1.8 than we are about Rule 1.7, Rule 1.7 is really the important conflict of interest rule because it's the rule that prohibits them in general. And then Rule 1.8 kind of goes into more detail, but only in some very limited situations. Well, the first one might be pretty common, actually. Rule 1.8, you entering into a transaction with a client where you have an adverse interest. Can you do business with your client? You have a business deal with the client. Or more frequently, that business deal, that adverse relationship comes as a result of the fee agreement. Your client owes you for the fee, they give you a security interest in their property. Well, that security interest is an adverse interest, so therefore this rule kicks in. The adverse interest is permitted, but it has to be reasonable, the client has to consent to it, and the client has to be advised in writing to obtain outside legal advice. So this rule kicks in anytime you have an adverse interest with your client, either from the fee arrangement or for some other reason. For example, you enter into a business deal with your client. You represent a car dealer, you buy a car. Potentially you have a lemon law claim against them or something, So anytime you engage in a business transaction with a client, potentially there's that adverse interest, and this rule would kick in. So in that situation, if I was buying a car from my car dealer client, I probably would make sure that I complied with this rule just to be on the safe side if there ever is any adverse thing comes up. The client has to consent to it. Client, are you consenting to me buying a car from you? Well, of course they are. It's fair and reasonable. You're paying the normal retail price, and the client consents to it. But also you have to advise the client in writing to obtain outside legal advice. That should be kind of a boilerplate in your contract and those kinds of things. Because I had one attorney who got himself reprimanded for violating this rule, kind of innocently, I think. So his cautionary tale kind of plays out like this. He was the attorney for his wife's family business. So his wife's parents owned a business, and they hired him to be the attorney for the business. So for that reason, his wife's parents were his client. And at some point during the marriage, the parents loaned them money to buy a house or something like that. So he had an adverse relationship. He owed money to his parents-in-law, who were also his clients. So he owed money to his client. So this rule kicked in. Innocently enough. The marriage wound up in divorce, and it turned into an ugly divorce. And at one point, the wife's parents marched into the Office of Lawyers Professional Responsibility to file a complaint. Was the transaction fair and reasonable? Yeah. Did you consent? Yeah. Well, then what's the problem? Say, well, our no-good son-in-law never advised us in writing that we should obtain outside legal advice. So if he would have done that, then he wouldn't have been in trouble. I think they recognized that they were just getting sucked into the fallout of this ugly divorce, and they left it at a private reprimand. But still, he could have avoided that if he would have just, had some piece of paper in the file saying, I think it would be a good idea for you to talk to another lawyer before you write us this check. Then he would have been covered. They don't have to take that advice, but you have to give the advice. So watch out for that. Anytime you have a business transaction with a client, make sure that that writing is in existence. Can your clients give you gifts? Absolutely. There's nothing wrong with that. But there are two things that are not permitted. One is you can't solicit a gift, or you can't solicit a substantial gift. So you can't say to your millionaire client, boy, sure would be nice if you gave me a new Rolls Royce today. You can't do that. But more importantly, you can't draft the document, such as a will, that names you as a beneficiary. You can't write the document that puts the gift into effect. So don't write a will naming yourself as a beneficiary. Now, there might be some exceptions to that. But even if there is an exception, you want to you don't want to do it for reasons I'll explain in a minute. Here the rules vary a little bit. So let's first look at the Iowa-Minnesota rule. And the Iowa-Minnesota rule says that it's okay as long as the client is a relative. So yeah, you can draft the will for your relative naming yourself as a beneficiary. That's okay as long as they're a relative in Iowa and Minnesota. Wisconsin, the rule is a little bit different. But for you Iowa and Minnesota attorneys who are listening, please listen to the Wisconsin version of the rule, and I'll explain why in a minute. Because now, if you're in Wisconsin, a slightly different rule applies. And the reason why the Wisconsin rule is different is because the Wisconsin Supreme Court, in adopting this rule, included the laws, you know, the laws of trusts and estates, they wrote it a little bit differently. So in Wisconsin, you are not allowed to write a will for anybody naming yourself as a beneficiary unless, first of all, the person is a relative, just like in Minnesota and Iowa, but not just any old relative. You have to be the natural object of the client's bounty, in the words of some 1840 case. So in other words, you have to be a close relative who would normally get a gift of about this size. The size of the gift has to be reasonable and natural. There can't be any grounds to believe that the will be contested, nor can there be any grounds to believe that the public will lose confidence in the integrity of the bar. Because, of course, everybody trusts attorneys, and, you know, if they learned about this will that you wrote, they would start telling lawyer jokes. We don't want that to happen. So that's written into the test in Wisconsin. Now, so they're pretty similar rules, but why should Minnesota and Iowa attorneys worry about that Wisconsin rule? Well, because, like I say, what Wisconsin did was, in Wisconsin, it's an all or nothing proposition. If you wrote this defective will in violation of this rule, two things will happen. Number one, you will get disbarred, and number two, the probate court will throw out the gift. You won't get the money anyway. In Minnesota and Iowa, the same rules or similar rules will be applying in the probate court. So you might, under the somewhat more lenient Minnesota rule, you might escape getting disbarred, but that's little consolation because the probate court threw off the will. You don't get any money because the Minnesota probate court or the Iowa probate court is probably going to be applying similar standards to this because, like I say, this came from some case in the 1840s, it's the common law in most states. So chances are a Minnesota or an Iowa court or a court in any other state would apply very similar rules. And you don't want to hand the probate judge that much discretion because how do you define these terms? What is the natural object of the bounty? You know, the probate judge says, well, you know, I don't like you. I don't want you to get the money, so I'm going to rule that you're not the natural object of the bounty. How do you appeal that? Or the judge says, well, I don't want you to get the money, I think the public will lose confidence in the integrity of the bar if I give you this money, so you're not going to get any money from this will. How do you argue against that? So in other words, you're giving a tremendous amount of discretion to the probate court to throw out your will. In Wisconsin, that insult to injury, you'll also get disbarred. Definitely in the Wisconsin, use extreme caution in those situations. But even in other states, you don't want to do that. So I would err on the side of caution here and never draft an instrument naming myself as a beneficiary because it's just too unpredictable what would happen. That's gifts from clients, the rule. Literary rights. I don't know how often this comes up, but your client doesn't have any money to pay you, but he signs over the book deal. So the next O.J. Simpson case walks into your office, and they don't have any money to pay you, but it's going to be a really big movie deal, and they sign over those movie rights to you. Well, no, you can't do that, because then you're at odds with your client, because you want the case to be a good movie. At that point, the client doesn't care anymore; they just want to get off. So you can't do that. You can't provide financial assistance to a client other than costs of litigation in some situations. What about your fee is being paid by somebody other than the client? Well, that happens all the time, and that's okay, but a few things you have to watch out for. So where can that come up? Insurance defense is one common situation. So the insurance company is paying you, but your client is the driver. So you're not getting paid by your client. You're getting paid by somebody else. Or in the criminal defense context, it comes up pretty often where this criminal defendant, they don't have any money to pay you, but their family is coughing up the money. That's the other common situation. Well, so it's okay as long as the client consents. So you go down to the jail and say, hey, is it okay if your parents pay my fee? He's probably going to say yes. But more importantly, you have to confidential information has to be treated properly, and the fee arrangement can't interfere with your independence. Now, the insurance company understands how this works, so they're not going to bug you too much. But relatives of the criminal defendant, they might feel that because they are paying you, they ought to have some say in how the case is carried out. And the answer is no, they don't have any say in how it's carried out. This one criminal defense attorney, he said it's not uncommon it's usually the mother. When I read this rule, he said, oh, I know who that is, that's mom. He's representing the defendant, but his fee is getting paid by mom. Well, it's not uncommon for mom to call him up and say, well, I want my son to get off, but I also want to make sure he learns his lesson from this. So can you make sure that he gets at least 30 days? And, well, he has to say no to that, because he can't take marching orders from the mom. He has to take marching orders from the client. Because remember, that's what Rule 1.2 said. You have to do exactly what your client tells you. So now if the client said, I need to be taught a lesson, can you make sure I get at least 30 days in jail? Well, then he has to go along with that. But just because the mother is paying the bill doesn't mean she gets any say and how it's carried out. And he also pointed out that the relatives often do not understand that rule. And when it is explained to them, they sometimes stop paying. So he usually gets his fee up front in those cases. Let's see, if you're representing more than one party, the aggregate settlement has to be approved by all of your clients. That makes so much sense. At first I couldn't think, why did they even bother putting that in the rules? Because obviously all of your clients have to approve of it. But that's just to stress the fact, as one attorney who took the program reminded me, she was a defense attorney. She worked for government entities who were getting sued for things. So if a police officer was being sued for excess force, or a city manager was getting sued for discrimination or something, well, she would be representing the individual employee who's getting sued, and she would also be representing the city council. More often than not, or pretty frequently in those situations, they would get a settlement offer. So, the police department is getting sued for, $3.8 million because this police officer used excess force. So they get this complaint and they do a little bit of discovery. And, well, the plaintiff's attorney discovers that, well, maybe the case isn't quite as strong as I thought it was. So I tell you what, he sends over a settlement offer. He says, instead of settling it for $3.8 million, we'll take $10,000. In those situations, typically she would find that her client, the city council, would grudgingly get out the checkbook and say, okay, we'll pay the $10,000 for this to go away. And then she would go to the individual client, the police officer who was accused of some wrongdoing, and say, hey, I got some good news for you. We're going to settle the case. The case is over. The city council is paying $10,000 for it to go away. And then the reaction is, well, wait a minute. No, that plaintiff does not deserve $10,000. They don't deserve 10 cents. I want to go to trial. Well, this rule basically says that, yeah, that individual client does have the veto power in that situation. So that makes her life a little bit more difficult. But every client, again, rule 1.2, it's just says that the client always makes the decisions. And here the client made that decision, yeah, I want to go to trial, even though it made her life a little bit more difficult. And she said she always sits down and explains, and eventually they grudgingly go along too. But this rule made her life a little bit more difficult. Whatever you do, never ask a client to prospectively waive a malpractice claim or to not turn you into disciplinary authorities. Because it's about, number one, it's a violation of this rule. Number two, it will just give the client ideas. So you don't want to talk about malpractice to the client. Because even asking them, even if they say no, it's a violation of this rule. So even if you say, please don't sue me for malpractice, I didn't do anything wrong. Well, you've just asked them to prospectively waive their claim. So that's a violation of this rule. So don't do that. Now, you can settle previous claims. But if with the restriction, though, that if the person is not represented by an attorney, you have to tell them that it probably would be a good idea to get outside legal advice before signing the settlement for a malpractice settlement. Never get a proprietary interest in a cause of action, the exceptions being an attorney's lien as governed by statute and the contingent fee in a civil case. But other than that, you can never have a proprietary interest in a cause of action. If you are related to another attorney in a familial or romantic capacity, so in other words, a family member or somebody you're dating, you shall not represent a client that's being represented by that other attorney. Even though that, Spencer Tracy and Catherine Hepburn did it, that's not permitted by this rule. Although maybe in that movie, maybe the client's consented to it or something, but that's generally not permitted. And a lawyer may not have sexual relations with the client unless that relationship predated the legal representation. That is Rule 1.8, a bunch of kind of specific rules in specific situations. But remember, again, though, that the most important conflict of interest rule is Rule 1.7, because that states the general rule, and these are just kind of a few arcane situations. Rule 1.8 concludes with a reminder that conflicts of interest are imputed. In other words, it's not your personal conflict of interest. In general, it goes with your firm. So if you are precluded from taking a case, then so are your partners and your employees and so forth. It's not a personal thing, it's a firm thing. We'll talk about that in more detail, though, in a minute when we get to Rule 1.10. But first, we have Rule 1.9, which we'll gloss over pretty quickly because even though it's kind of a complicated rule, there is usually an easy solution 99% of the time when we're talking about duties to former clients. You don't have to worry too much about Rule 1.9 because most of the time you can resolve the situation by saying, wait, I can't take this new case against my former client because of client confidentiality. So remember, under Rule 1.6, everything that happened in that case, everything that you know, that you learned during the course of that representation, well, it's confidential. Even though it's not confidential for the general public, it is confidential for you because you learned it in the course of a representation. Well, so you obviously learned a lot of things about your former client when you were representing them. Well, you can never use that information against them. So you wouldn't be able to properly represent a new client today. So that's how you resolve these. You can't use confidential information against your former client. Now, if there's absolutely no confidential information because the case is, 100 years old or whatever, well, then you might have to dig a little bit deeper into Rule 1.9. So it might be permissible in some rare situations. But in general, confidential information can never be used against a former client. And that's usually kind of the end of the matter. So we don't have to look at Rule 1.9 in a lot of detail. Okay, as promised, Rule 1.10 talks about imputed disqualification. And again, the general rule is that anytime you have a conflict of interest, well, that conflict of interest is also belongs to your partners and associates and any other attorney in your firm. Because conflicts of interest are imputed. Rule 1.10 goes into a lot more detail because it talks about what are the employment ramifications of that. I get a job with a different law firm. Well, the general rule is, they now have my conflicts of interest. But in the employment situation like that, conflicts of interest that I bring with me to my new job are kind of considered my personal baggage. So you hire me. You decide to hire me. So I'm working for your office, and therefore any conflict of interest that I have is now your conflict of interest, including all the ones relating to my former clients. So, for example, let's say that I used to be the attorney. I'm here in Minnesota. Of course, one of our largest employers is 3M Corporation. So I was the general counsel for 3M Corporation. I worked for them, and in the course of my representation, I learned all kinds of confidential information about them. I know the secret formulas for their Post-it notes and everything. So I have all kinds of confidential information. Well, so therefore, I can't have cases against my former client. That kind of stands to reason. But you hired me. Well, now you can't have cases against my former client. The day after you hire me, you have this injured plaintiff hobble into your office, and they were injured by a defective 3M product. They just have horrible injuries and, a multi-million-dollar case against 3M. And they come in and say, can you sue 3M on my behalf? And, well, what do you have to say to them? You have to say, I'm sorry, we can't take your case because we have a conflict of interest, because Attorney Clem works for me now, and, he used to be their attorney, so we have a conflict of interest, so you'll have to take your multi-million-dollar case elsewhere. Well, you think about that for a minute, and you ask yourself the question, what is more important to the future of this law firm? Is it the employment relationship with Attorney Clem, or is it this new client that just walked in the door today? You think about that for about 1 second, and you tell the client, excuse me for a moment, please. And then you walk into my office and say, you're fired. And you send me packing, and I take all my stuff with me, including my conflicts of interest, because those were my personal baggage. So unless I shared that information with you, those conflicts of interest that I brought with me to my new job, I take with me when I leave. So after you fire me, then you can go in and tell the client, yeah, sign right here. We'll be happy to take your case. So that's how imputed disqualification works. That's the subject of Rule 1.10. Now, let's say, for example, that my I worked in the private sector, but let's say I worked for the government. I was not an attorney in private practice, but I was a county attorney. I was the assistant county attorney in Ramsey County, Minnesota. If you strictly applied all of the previous rules, you might find that, who is my client when I worked for the county attorney's office? Well, my client was either the county or the state, however you want to look at it. So, my client was the state of Minnesota. If that was a private company that I worked for, well, there'd be a conflict of interest. I could never have cases against my former employer. But that doesn't make much sense in that context because that would mean that I could never practice in the area of criminal law without moving to another state. Now, that doesn't really seem fair. So here, when the former employer is a government agency, the rule is slightly different, and there, instead of worrying about who the former client was, we worry about the particular matter that they were involved in. So yeah, I can go work in the private sector, and I can have cases against the state of Minnesota. So in other words, I can be a criminal defense attorney, even though I'm going up against my former client, because as long as it's not a particular case that I was involved in. But even particular cases that I was involved in, that might still limit my job prospects a little bit because there are only so many criminal defense firms out there. And I was an overworked public servant in the county attorney's office, and I had 100 files at a time going on, so I had cases against every firm in town. Well, I can still go to work for those firms, but I have to be screened off, and I can't they can't talk about that case with me. And I can't share part of the fee. So from a former government employee, a former government lawyer, that applies to me. Now, what about if I'm not a former government attorney, but I'm an attorney of a former government employee of some other kind? I worked for the government 10 years ago. Well, this rule has a provision in there that still applies in that situation. Any confidential information that you learn during the course of your government employment, you cannot use that information in the course of the practice of law, because that's probably a violation of some other law, but it's also a violation of these rules. I'm most of the time I'm not a government employee, but once a year I go to work for the government once a year, and I get a government paycheck. Working as an election judge, and incidentally, I always put in the plug here that attorneys, call up your county election office or whoever handles that wherever you are and volunteer to be an election judge because they really need people, and lawyers can really perform an important public service doing that. But anyway, I'm getting paid by you know, I get a paycheck from Ramsey County. In fact, I have to check my bank account, see if that's deposited because Election Day was a few weeks ago. But they don't pay very much, but they pay a little bit. It adds up though after a long day. Minimum wage when you work 15 hours a day, that's quite a bit of money. But anyway, while I'm working for the government, I have access to confidential information. In fact, we have now, sometimes when I do early voting, I have access to the statewide computer system listing every single voter in the state. And I could go in there and find, confidential information about all kinds of people if I wanted to. But three things would happen. Number one is I would get fired from my government job because we were told in no uncertain terms, this information is for official use only. Number two, I very well could face criminal charges for doing that. And number three, I might get disbarred because this rule says it's a violation of these rules, to misuse that confidential information. So if you ever worked for the government in any capacity whatsoever, Rule 1.11 applies to you. Or if you were a former judge, Rule 1.12 basically states the same rules. Even if you were never a judge, but you were a arbitrator or mediator, well, then those rules also apply to you. Rule 1.13 talks about an organization as a client. And basically kind of restates the common law rule that if you're an attorney for the corporation, well, then you're the attorney for the corporation. You're not necessarily the attorney for individuals within the organization. And if you are representing individuals within the company or within the agency or within the organization, then you are, that's a dual representation, and you have to be mindful of the potential conflict of interest implications. So if you're representing the company and the company president, well, you have two clients, and they might potentially could have adverse interest. Or if you're it's more likely to have adverse interest if you're representing, the company and an employee. So you're representing the trucking company and the truck driver. Well, there's a potential for conflict of interest there. If you are, but on the other hand, if you're not specifically representing individuals, well, you don't owe any duties to them, with one exception. Even if you are not representing a person within the organization, you still have a duty to clear up any misunderstandings they might have about your role. So, if you're representing the trucking company who's getting sued for the accident, but you're not representing the driver, because maybe you plan to throw the driver under the truck, you're not representing them. But if they have a misunderstanding of your role and they think that you are their lawyer, you have to tell them, no, I am not your lawyer. I am the company's lawyer. You should find your own lawyer. And there's a specific duty there. Rule 1.13, we hear the word whistleblower in the news recently here. Well, you might have an obligation to be a whistleblower because of Rule 1.13. Because now, if you have to worry about this too often, you should seek employment elsewhere because life is too short to worry about this. But you work for an organization and you discover there's illegality going on within the organization. Well, normally, if you're representing an individual, and you discover your individual client is engaging in illegal activity, well, there's a duty of confidentiality that you owe the client. And you can't just say, I'm going to call the cops on you, unless, those other situations that we talked about earlier arise. Why would an organization be different? Well, you work for the chemical company, and you discover that there is illegal dumping going on. So, every night at midnight, some guy takes his truck full of toxic waste and dumps it into a river somewhere in wanton disregard of all the pollution laws. That's an individual doing that, and there's kind of a legal fiction that that person is acting on his own behalf. He's not acting on behalf of the company, but on the other hand, he might get the company in a lot of trouble. So if you discover that happening, you have a duty to bring that to you have a duty to try to stop that, and normally that is discharged by telling your boss. So you discover that there's this illegal dumping going on, so you go into work the next day and you say, hey, boss, there's illegal dumping going on. And then in an ideal world, your boss will say, well, thank you for telling us that. We'll put an end to it immediately. And you did your client a good deed because now they're not going to get in trouble for this. Things don't always work out quite that nicely. So perhaps your boss has, they just blow you off. They don't want to do anything about it. You have a duty to keep going up the chain of command. Even if you get fired, because normally, as we'll learn, when you get fired, well, that's the end of it. You don't have any more duties to your client. But here you have that one duty to maybe put in that last hurrah to tell the big boss what was going on. Or you might even have a duty to turn your client in to the regulatory authorities. So you discover this illegal dumping, you get fired as a result of it. So you you call up EPA. What happens when you call up the EPA? Well, two things will happen: is your client gets $1 million fine for dumping, but also the dumping comes to an end because they the enforcement people finally step in. So even though there was that fine for today, there will not be $1 million fine tomorrow. So if that is your motivation for placing that phone call, then it's okay, and you have a duty to do that under this rule, under Rule 1.13. We should give the for our podcast callers, we should give the next code number. The next code number for this portion of the program is C97. C is in Charlie, 97. C97 is the next code word for this program. As we conclude Rule 1.13. Rule 1.14 talks about a client with a diminished capacity. Now, this rule is in here because, remember, Rule 1.2 says that whatever your client tells you to do, that's what you have to do. You can't, just because your client wants to do something that's foolish or that's not in their best interest, you still have to do it. Now, you might want to quit at that point. If your client is telling you to do something that's harmful to the client, you might want to go to flip to Rule 1.16, which says, client, I quit. I'm not going to represent you anymore. But as long as you are representing them, you have to abide by their wishes. If your client wants to, send the money, if they got an email from their rich uncle in Nigeria, you can't stop them. You can't say no. I'm gonna tackle you so you don't send your money to the scam artist. No, you can't do that because that's your client's decision if they want to do that. Unless they're doing it because they're acting in diminished capacity. So if because of their medical or mental condition, if there's some identifiable reason why they're doing this unwise action, then this rule kicks in and says that you may act contrary to their wishes. So in other words, Rule 1.14 is an exception to Rule 1.2, but because it's an exception, the burden of proof will be on you to say that, this is an exception, of this is a time where I'm not going to abide by my client's decision. Because of this rule, you might be permitted to violate confidentiality. So in other words, your elderly client is suffering from dementia and they are, sending their money someplace where they have, no good reason to send it. Well, then, normally you can't just talk to your client's family and say, here's what my client is doing. But in that situation, that's an exception. But again, the burden of proof will be on you to show that the client has diminished capacity. Now, this rule is permissive. It says you may take these protective actions. This rule does not say that you must do anything in particular. But again, that comes under your general rule of competence, under Rule 1.1. You have to act competently on behalf of your client. If your elderly dementia client is, going to send their money to Nigeria, well, then, you as a competent attorney really have to, take some action to prevent that from happening. Although this one does not say that you must act. But again, I think arguably that comes under that general duty of competence. Okay, Rule 1.15 talks about clients' property. And you have to, obviously, you have to use reasonable care in, if you're entrusted with things belonging to your client. But specifically, the Rule 1.15 talks a lot about the trust account because mostly you're worried about money here. And there are two rules that you have to always remember when getting money belongs to a client or some third party during the course of a representation. And first of all, the first part of that rule is that money that does not belong to you must always go in the trust account. You must go in a trust account. And there are really no exceptions to that. Anytime money comes into your hands, in connection with a representation, it immediately has to go into your trust account. And normally that will be your pooled trust account, your IOLTA account. That stands for Interest on Lawyers Trust Account. So normally it goes into that trust account. There might be some situations where you need to set up a separate trust account for this client. But client money can only be, there's only one place where client money can go, or third-party money. That's in your trust account. The corollary to that rule is that your money can never be in the trust account, but there are two exceptions to that rule. First is any money that belongs to you and the client jointly. That can be in the trust account temporarily. So you get the settlement check, you know, that's made payable to both you and the client, you temporarily deposit that in the trust account, but then you have to promptly disperse it. So that's one time when your money can be in the trust account. The other time is a reasonable amount to cover bank service charges. And one Iowa attorney told me that he was told specifically, and this is the number that I've given before, but he was told by somebody at the lawyer's trust account board in that state that $100 is the correct amount. You can keep $100 of your money in the trust account to cover, you know, bank service charges as they crop up. You can't keep $1,000 of your money or $10,000 of your money in there, though, because you're nervous. You're not very good at math, so you want to make sure that you keep extra money in there as a cushion. Well, no, you can't do that. The rule does not say that you can keep a cushion. It says that you can keep a reasonable amount to cover reasonable bank service charges, which was defined by one state employee as $100. Now we're not going to go into a lot of detail on the trust account rules, because for one thing, they vary a little bit from state to state. There are a lot of very specific provisions. I'll tell you where to look for those, and I will hit some of the high points or some kind of surprising ones that you might not have noticed in your particular state. Where to find those rules? Well, in the Minnesota and Iowa version of Rule 1.15 is quite short because it incorporates by reference a separate document, and Iowa works the same way. So both Iowa and Minnesota have a separate document which lays out specific trust account rules kind of in great detail, and also record-keeping requirements for attorneys. Even if you don't handle client funds, there's a kind of a minimal level of record keeping that you have to go through. Basically, you the same requirements that the IRS imposes on everyone, pretty much, saying that you have to keep track of your income sufficiently so that you can figure out how much income there was. So you're required to do that even if you're not handling client funds in any way. You have to keep rudimentary records. But all the states have some very specific rules about trust accounts that you want to look at, because I know in Minnesota I have to sign something, an affidavit once a year saying, yep, I read all the rules in this separate document and I'm following all of them. And I think most other states have a similar provision in their, you know, renewal affidavit for bar members. So you want to look at those, because in Minnesota and Iowa, it's a separate document. In Wisconsin, it's written right into the Rule 1.15. So Wisconsin Rule 1.15 is considerably longer than other rules. A couple things that stand out, if I was a Wisconsin attorney, I would be in violation of one of those Wisconsin rules, because Wisconsin is very specific. That says that your trust account, everything associated with your trust account has to have the magic words trust account written on it. The bank statement that you get from the bank has to have those magic words trust account without abbreviation. The uh, uh, the your checkbook has to have the words trust account without abbreviation. The reason why my Minnesota trust account was not in compliance with that Wisconsin rule is because when I get the bank statement, it does not have the words trust account, I don't think, or maybe they've changed it recently. When I get my trust account statement, it's addressed to Richard P. Clem, MN, LTAB, which is an abbreviation for Minnesota Lawyer Trust Account Board, but it doesn't have the words trust account anywhere in my bank statement. So if I were a Wisconsin attorney, I would call up the bank and say, hey, you have to change how my bank statement looks, otherwise I'm going to get in trouble. So if you are a Wisconsin attorney, your homework is to look at your checkbook and make sure it says trust account. Wisconsin has some very specific rules about, well, can you fund your trust account with a credit card? You want to get, you need to get a retainer from the client, and, you want a $1,000 retainer, let's say. And while they don't have $1,000, they'll say, can you take a credit card? The answer is no, basically. It theoretically would be possible in Wisconsin because they lay out exactly how it would work. Minnesota does not say, I don't think it says one way or another, but I wouldn't do it, and the reason why is because when you accept credit cards, you have the potential for somebody to dispute that charge, and you have the potential for the credit card company to take money out of your account. Well, that's one thing that you never want to have. You'll get in trouble if you have third parties with permission to take money out of your trust account. So that's why it's extremely difficult, if not impossible, to accept credit cards for your trust account in Wisconsin, and probably why it's a bad idea in just about any other state, even though it's not explicitly addressed. So in that situation, I would tell the client, well, you know what, the bank is just down the street. Go down there, get a cash advance, and bring me the money, or bring me a cashier's check, even. So don't accept credit cards in that situation. Accepting credit cards for anything up front is kind of problematic. So the only time I would accept credit card payment for legal fees would be after I'm all done. Because it's just kind of practically impossible to get that money into a trust account from a credit card. Okay, Rule 1.16 talks about declining or terminating representation. You never have to take a case in the first place. Just because somebody wants you to be their lawyer, you don't have to take their case. Once you do take their case, can you quit? So this rule answers that question, but it also talks about the cases that you must never take or where you must quit. You must quit, or you shouldn't take the case in the first place, if that representation will result in a violation of one of the rules, or if your physical or mental condition is just such that it materially impairs your ability. In those situations, you should not take the case. Or if you're fired. That's kind of weird. It says, well, if you're fired, you have to quit. Well, that's just stressing the fact that the client always has an absolute power to fire you, right or wrong. They might be in breach of contract, but they still have they can still fire you. You might be able to sue them for damages for firing you inappropriately, but what you can't do is continue representing them after they say the magic words, you're fired. Can you quit? You don't like this client anymore. You want to quit. Can you quit? And the answer is yes, almost always, because there's a list of, 10 or 5, 6 categories where you can quit. Including other. So yeah, you can almost always quit. But we're not going to spend a lot of time looking at those six reasons, because there's an exception that sometimes swallows up the rule. And that exception is you can't quit without first following any court rules calling for notice or permission. So in other words, in the Minnesota Rules of Criminal Procedure, it says, before an attorney withdraws in a criminal case, you have to get the court's permission. Well, that rule takes precedence over this rule. So even though you fit into all six of these categories, you haven't been paid, you don't like the client, whatever, even though you fit in all those categories, you still can't quit without getting the court's permission. And in Minnesota, apparently this varies a little bit from state to state. In Minnesota, the court will not give you that permission. If you say, "Judge, can I get off of this case?" the court will say, "No, you're stuck." So other states apparently are a little bit more lenient. So that's why we don't look at the rule too much, because the exception kind of swallows it up. After you quit or you get fired, you have to give the client back their papers if they want them. Because number one, the rule says so. Number two, if it's gotten to the point where the client has fired you or you've fired the client, if it's gotten to that point, the client is not very happy. The last thing you want to do is give them one more reason to be unhappy, namely saying, "No, you can't have your file back." So just give them back their papers. Maybe they'll go away. Maybe that'll be enough to pacify them, because nothing good will come from saying, "No, you can't have your papers back." You can charge them for if it's in your contract that says so, yeah, you can charge them for making copies. So you can say, "Well, you signed this contract that says you have to pay $1 per page for copies, and I need to make a copy of the file before giving it to you." Well, if the contract says that, then yes, you can charge that. But what you can't do is you can't condition return of the file upon payment of those copying costs. You say, "Well, yeah, I'll give you your file back as soon as you pay me the $1,000 copying costs." If you say that, you can't do that. What you can say is, "Here's your file. I'm going to send you a bill for $1,000, and I hope you pay it." I guess that's okay if the contract calls for that. But again, if things ever reach that point, don't fight over the file. Just give them back their file. If you want copies, make the copies, and don't charge them for them or whatever. It's just going to make things worse. Rule 1.17 talks about the sale of a law practice. As we hinted earlier, one thing you're never allowed to do is pay referral fees. But the sale of a business is kind of like a referral fee. So that's why this rule is here, saying, yeah, you can sell a law office as a going business, as long as it's a bona fide, going out of business sale. You're really leaving the practice of law, or leaving one geographic area. I have offices in Minneapolis and Madison, and I'm closing my Madison office, so I sell that office to another Wisconsin attorney. That's okay. Or I'm leaving a practice area. I'm gonna I have my combination bankruptcy DWI practice, and I'm gonna sell the DWI practice. That's okay. But it has to be a legitimate sale of the business. It can't be. You can't use this as a ruse for selling individual cases. Okay, a prospective client is somebody who comes to you with about forming an attorney-client relationship. And basically, the Rule 1.18 says that anytime anybody talks to you about the possibility of hiring you as an attorney, well, all of that information that you gather from them is confidential. Even if it's kind of done in bad faith on their part, because they just want to make sure that you're excluded. There's an exception in that case if they're acting kind of in bad faith and you're trying to do your best to make sure that you don't get tainted. Well, your partners and associates can still have the case against them. So anyway, there in about it's taken us almost 2 hours to get through Rule 1, and so you see we're only about halfway through the material, that's because Rule 1 is kind of the most important. That's kind of the meat of the rule, and because that deals with your relationship with your client. The other ones go much faster. For example, Rule 2.1, Rule 2, we're going to get through in about 5 minutes. Rule 2.1 just makes clear that if you're giving legal advice to your client, yeah, you can also give them other information. You just by going to law school, you didn't forget everything else you already knew. So you can, yeah, you're permitted to give your moral, economic, social, and political views to your client, even though you're representing him as an attorney. You don't have to worry about 2.2 because we don't have a Rule 2.2 in Iowa, Wisconsin, or most other states. It was proposed by the ABA, mediating disputes between clients. It was just so messy that very few states actually adopted that rule. The net effect, though, is that the number on some of those rules might be different in different states. But in Iowa and Wisconsin, Rule 2.3 says that if you're you are one thing that you might do as an attorney is evaluate your client matter for the benefit of a third party. So, your client hires you to write an opinion letter to the bank or to the title company or whatever. That's something attorneys do. But this rule just says that before disclosing any negative information, if your client says, write this opinion letter for me, and before you send an opinion letter that says, my client doesn't have a leg to stand on, you want to make sure you get informed consent before you offer a negative opinion on behalf of your client. Kind of common sense. Here in the materials they say Iowa Rule 2.3, Iowa Rule 2.4. That also includes Minnesota and Wisconsin. Iowa Wisconsin Rule 2.4 says if you're serving as a third party neutral, as an arbitrator or mediator, you have a duty to the people appearing before you to clear up any misunderstandings they might have as to your role in the case. Even though they're not your client, you have that limited duty to them. As promised, Rule 2 went much faster. Rules 3 and 4, where we typically conclude this the second hour of the program, we're going to go through really fast because these rules are unimportant, because Rule 3 and 4 are kind of the heart of our ethical obligation to the general public and to the court system, to the administration of justice. So these are very, very important rules. I'm going to go through them real fast for a couple of reasons. Well, number one is a lot of them are kind of common sense because you're not supposed to lie, cheat, and steal. Well, you already knew that, so why spend a lot of time talking about it? Number two, you seem like a honest attorney is taking this program, so you're probably not going to do any of the stuff in Rule 3 and 4, so we don't have to belabor it too much. The third reason is, assuming I'm wrong and you are going to do all this bad stuff in Rule 3 and 4, well, me telling you not to probably isn't going to make a lot of difference. So even though it's very important, we're going to gloss through it very fast, but we'll stop and look at a couple of points that maybe are a little bit counterintuitive that we might not have noticed otherwise. Rule 3.1 just says that you're only supposed to bring meritorious claims. You're not supposed to bring frivolous claims or defenses, with the exception of a criminal case. No matter how frivolous the defense is, the defendant always has the right to say not guilty and put the state to its proof in any case where that could result in the deprivation of liberty. That's Rule 3.1, meritorious claims. Rule 3.2, expediting litigation. You have to use reasonable efforts to expedite litigation, but consistent with your interest of your client. So if it's in your client's interest to delay, well, then you should delay. But you can't delay just because you're, not very efficient or whatever. You have to expedite litigation. You have to be candid toward the court. You can't make a false statement of fact or fail to disclose. You can't offer evidence that's false. You can't even offer misleading evidence or whatever. That's Rule 3.3. We could spend hours talking about that. You have to be fair to the other side, says Rule 3.4. You have to, most of this stuff, you're not going to do any of this stuff. Ethical attorneys would never dream of unlawfully obstructing somebody's access to evidence or falsifying evidence or anything. So most of these in the abstract, they look pretty straightforward. But what about this last one though? Well, in the abstract, this sounds pretty good. You as an attorney should never request of somebody other than your client, never request that they not voluntarily give information to the other side. Well, that sounds good in the abstract, but there are some situations where, well, maybe you do want to do that. So you have to be aware of this rule and you have to think about it a little bit. So for example, you're talking to this witness about what happened in the case, your opponent, the attorney on the other side, is just this really obstreperous attorney that nobody likes and makes life difficult for everybody. So you're talking to this witness and you say, well, the other lawyer on the other side might give you a call, but just beware, he's going to twist all of your words. And he's going to try to make you look foolish. And you know what? If I were you, I just wouldn't talk to him at all. Well, maybe that was the right thing to say. But when you do say that, think about this rule. Because that's, you just told somebody not to voluntarily give information to the other side in violation of this rule, unless if the following conditions are met. The person is a relative employee, that person's interest will not be adversely affected. So it might be appropriate in a particular case, but read the rule carefully to make sure. Rule 3.5, impartiality and decorum of the tribunal. You're not supposed to, a lot of things here, you're not supposed to do like disrupt a tribunal. You probably wouldn't want to do that. Jury conduct. This is the rule where it talks about juror contact. And if you're a litigator, you know that you're not supposed to talk to members of the jury, and you know how those rules work. But some attorneys who take my program are not litigators. Maybe they're not even practicing law full time. Their guys kind of gloss over at this point. But I remind them that there's one provision here that applies to every attorney, even if you've never been in court in your life, because it says, during a trial, a lawyer who is not connected with the case. So what case are we talking about? Well, we're talking about the one you're not connected with. Well, you're not connected with any case. We're talking about any case, anywhere in the world, any jury case anywhere. You are prohibited from communicating with the juror concerning the case. So where could this come into play? You're not a litigator. You don't even know where the courthouse is. Your neighbor just got picked for jury duty. And so your neighbor comes over and says, hey, guess what? I just got picked for jury duty. Well, so at that point you say, well, congratulations, and please do your civic duty well or whatever. And you leave it at that, that's okay. But then your neighbor starts blurting out information about the case. He says, yeah, I think the guy is guilty because, this and that. And, here's what I think. Well, your neighbor should know better than to do that, because the very last thing that the judge said that day before he left the courtroom was, don't talk about the case with anybody. And that's exactly what he's doing. But unfortunately, you're also going to get into trouble because you're violating this rule, because you're communicating with the juror concerning the case. Make sure you distance yourself from those conversations. And if it's bad enough, you have an obligation to, if you discover jury misconduct, well, then even though you're not involved in the case, you have a duty to bring that to the court's attention. So you have to track, have to figure out where the courthouse is. So your Facebook friend in Australia is on a jury, and they post that they're committing this jury misconduct. Well, this rule says that you have to track down the judge in Australia and report that person. So watch out for that. Trial publicity is a subject covered by Rule 3.6. Before we get to that, though, I'm going to give another code word, and that is D08. D is in Delta 08. D08 is the next code number for this segment of the program. As we turn from D08 to Rule 3.6, trial publicity. Here, when you look at it, it's talking mostly about criminal stuff, but this applies to any jury matter or any criminal case. And it says you should not make public statements if you think there is a substantial likelihood that they will prejudice the matter. Well, I would make the argument that says, the First Amendment says maybe you should prejudice the matter a little bit. And you would have my wholehearted support if you did that, because, your client is getting maligned in the newspaper and you want to get their side out there. Well, there's, potentially you're going to be accused of prejudicing the jury. I would say, well, that's your First Amendment right to do that, to make sure that that side of the story gets out there. But be aware that somebody else is not going to interpret it quite as charitably as I am. So anytime you make public pronouncements in a case that's potentially going to go to a jury, you want to remember that this rule is there and keep it in mind. Rule 3.7 says that a lawyer who's appearing in a case generally can't be a witness unless, about your fees or about that, you served the papers, something uncontroversial, or there would be hardship otherwise. If you're a prosecutor or former prosecutor, be sure to read Rule 3.8. You're not supposed to bring cases that are not supported by probable cause. If you become aware of miscarriages of justice when you were in the prosecutor's office, even you have a duty to try to clear those up. And depending on the state, that might continue for your lifetime. Be mindful of that if you're a former prosecutor. If you are an advocate in a non-adjudicative proceeding, I was testifying before the city council on the they charged me $12 for a garbage pickup because that was wrong. They should not have charged that extra $12. So I appealed it, and in the process of appealing this $12 charge that I had to, pay for parking downtown a couple of times. The main point I made was they have to have a little bit more streamlined approach for handling these $12 appeals because nobody is going to be as dumb as I am to go down there and waste their whole day appealing $12. So my main argument was, you have to clean up the system a little bit so that there's an easier way, a streamlined way for citizens to appeal these small charges. So I was testifying before the city council. Well, if I had, and I was there on my own behalf, and also mostly as a concerned citizen, because I wanted to get that out there. But if somebody had been, if somebody had been paying me to be there, this rule says I had a duty to disclose that information. So that's what Rule 3.9 says. If you want to see my test, I have a link to it. If you click on richardclem.com and then you click on recent cases, I have summaries of recent cases, and on that page where I have that case summarized, and I can't even think of the name of the case, there's a link about the city council hearing, so you can watch that video. So anyway, that's Rule 3.9. Rule 4, as we conclude here in about the next 5 minutes, you have to be truthful in your statements to others. When you're dealing with the public, you have to be truthful when you talk to people. But there might be an exception, like a legitimate investigative technique. Sometimes involves a little bit of deception. So, for example, they One area where it comes up is a test or in a civil case. We don't have a lot of time to cover that, but you hire actors to say false things, to see what the other side does about them. Well, most states say that's okay, but you have to be careful anytime you're making false statements because Rule 4.1 is implicated. You have to respect the rights of third parties. Okay, Rule 5, I guess, is where we'll conclude this section of the program. Rule 5, if you're the boss, Rule 5.1 and 5.3 says you have to have systems in place to make sure that the other attorneys and non-attorneys in your office conform with your professional obligations. Rule 5.2 says that if your boss tells you to do something illegal, well, that's still a violation of the rules, even though your boss directed you to do it. There is an exception, though, if it's a gray area and your boss makes a reasonable resolution, then you are protected under Rule 5.2. Rule 5.4 says that you can't share fees with a non-attorney. And finally, Rule 5.5 talks about the unauthorized practice of law, which is the one thing you're not capable of. No attorney can ever engage in the unauthorized practice of law because you're authorized. But where it kind of comes into play is what can you do in other jurisdictions? So if you are a Wisconsin attorney, can you do various things in Minnesota? Here, the key thing to remember is that whenever those issues come up, you do not look at your own state's version of Rule 5.5. You look at the other state's version of Rule 5.5. And you can actually do quite a bit in another state because you can do things relating to your cases back home. So if I have a Minnesota case and I need to take a deposition in Wisconsin, I can certainly do that. I'm not illegally practicing law in Wisconsin because it reasonably relates to my case in Minnesota. And the other thing I can do is that if I reasonably believe that I will be admitted to pro hac vice in another state, if I reasonably believe that I will be able to be admitted in another state, then I can do things in preparation for that case, even though I'm not yet admitted. So that's kind of a broad exception, things that you can do. Rule 5.6 says that you can't have covenants not to compete, basically, in that context. What about if you're working in an area that's kind of related to the practice of law, but not overall the practice of law? So like tax preparation or whatever. Rule 5.7 addresses whether or not the rules of professional conduct apply to you when you're doing that related field of law. For whatever reason, Wisconsin has not adopted Rule 5.7. They have an unrelated Rule 5.7 talking about a lawyer practicing as an LLC or some similar professional organization. Our final code number for this section of the program is E22. E is an echo 22. E22 is the last code number for this segment of the program. For those of you listening on the podcast, we will continue here momentarily. And although actually, we have a slight technical difficulty here as I have to log back into my account to shut us out. I'll just pause real briefly though while I do that. If there are any questions from the live audience today. Hearing none, thank you for attending. I will end this portion of the recording. We'll continue with our podcast in a few minutes.